While we're waiting. Oh, there we go. It's up. My name is Jean O'Connor. I have a couple disclaimers to make, and none have anything to do with financial interest, really. I'll tell you that I am a JD MPH, recently completed my DRPH at UNC Chapel Hill, and this presentation was prepared in my capacity. I'm as a doctoral student at UNC Chapel Hill. I also happen to work for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, but not in water quality issues or environmental health. So it's important to them that I tell you that the findings and conclusions in this presentation are mine alone and do not represent the views of the US Department of Health and Human Services. So that's always fun to get to give a disclaimer at the start of your talk. But again, no financial interests. So the topic of my talk is fluoridation, water fluoridation. And by way of another disclaimer, I have to tell you that I'm not a health administrator, so I can see that there are probably a number of people in this room who are. But this is really about water fluoridation as a public health intervention. So fluoridation of drinking water is considered actually one of the 10 great achievements of public health in the 20th century. And optimal fluoridation of water is a safe and inexpensive intervention for preventing tooth decay, tooth loss, dental caries. And those things are associated with other chronic and acute health problems, so it's important that we prevent them. Because more than half of children are affected by dental caries, and actually almost 95% of adults have some type of dental caries. Data suggests that we're continuing to make progress from the last century. In 1992, there were 44 million people who received their water from a water supply that was fluoridated. And in 2000, that number was up to actually approximately 162 million, or 65.8% of the population served by public water systems. Some states and localities still lag behind the national average, and state-specific percentages for the number of individuals covered range from 2% in Utah, this is as of 2002 in a CDC MMWR, to 100% in Washington, D.C. So a lot of variation across the U.S. in terms of receipt of water from a fluoridated system. Like most things that affect public health, fluoridation practices are carried out at the state and local level. And many of you probably know, most of us have heard this, that because of the 10th Amendment, because the police powers are reserved to states, state public health laws really do matter to public health in this country. And despite the public health benefits of water fluoridation, there's been some opposition to the use of fluoride. Claims from groups and individuals about adverse health impacts, and as well, religious and philosophical objections to receiving fluoridated drinking water. There's anecdotal and media reports that fluoridation has been the subject of some legal challenges. So that brings me to my research question, which was, how many such challenges to state or local public health authorities to fluoridate water have occurred? What have been the outcomes of those cases? And why did the courts arrive at their rulings? To look at this question, I conducted a search online using a legal research database. There are two proprietary databases, and I understand I'm not allowed to name proprietary systems, so I'll just tell you it was one of those. And I searched state appellate court cases, and I found 188 cases total that contained the stem of the word fluoride. I narrowed the search to cases that involved only issues of constitutionality or preemption using a Boolean search string. And as of January 2009, which is when I conducted this research, my search yielded 16 cases in 14 states. And those cases were decided between 1953 and 2005. And in all but two cases, every fluoridation decision on appeal found in favor of the local government or the local health department's ability to fluoridate the water. Now, this was very interesting to me because I've conducted some similar work around tobacco control. And in contrast, a similar study that my colleagues and I actually conducted of state court decisions about tobacco control ordinances, in those cases, local public health interests succeeded in only about half of 21 cases. So I wanted to just talk with you a little bit about tobacco control, because I think there are some very interesting parallels here to local authority related to fluoridation. The tobacco industry has continued over the past 20 years to pursue state level preemption of local tobacco control ordinances. In other words, they would like for control of tobacco to reside at the state level. They would not like for local governments to have the ability to do things such as require clean indoor air. And that strategy by the tobacco industry has been documented, and a number of researchers have looked at that and its success over time. But we know that the judiciary is important, and the decisions that courts make are very important to how we interpret and enforce statutes. And in the study that I'm referring to, that was about tobacco control ordinances, we found that when smoke-free indoor air ordinances were challenged on the basis of preemption, again, local control being preempted by state control, the outcome in those court cases really varied depending on state-specific legal issues. So very interesting contrast here with fluoridation. In that same study, we found that outcomes of seemingly similar cases regarding the validity of local smoke-free indoor air ordinances across states really varied, and that presented a challenge for public health officials looking for clear guidance about what to do when they were faced with a challenge to a local tobacco control ordinance. And in that study, the 21 cases in 19 states that were decided between 1987 and 2007. So right there, you can also see an interesting time difference. The fluoridation cases span many more decades. And across the 19 states in that tobacco control study, there were three common factors that courts determined were necessary for a local ordinance to survive a legal challenge. And so when we looked at all of those cases across all the states, we found that the courts were fairly consistently saying things like the local government must have the authority to adopt an ordinance, the ordinance must not conflict with the state constitution, and state statutes must not explicitly or impliedly preempt the ordinance. So in tobacco control, we sort of have this mixed bag. So very interesting contrast with challenges to local fluoridation ordinances, because when we look at the cases in fluoridation, and this is a table of the cases that I found through my research, we actually find that in all but two, the local public health authorities were successful. And in those two cases, which are listed in red, the City of Manchester case, as well as the City of Fargo case, we have some interesting things that suggest, in fact, actually, that the courts were looking for reasons to find in favor of the public health authorities on fluoridation. In the City of Manchester case, the court found that the city had the authority to pass a referendum related to fluoridation, to ask for the city to pass it, but the state statute would have to be amended, and I'll come back to that in a minute. And in the City of Fargo, a really interesting breach of contract case. But in the rest, you can see that the arguments or the challenges that were raised, which is in that third column, raised by most of the individuals seeking to stop fluoridation of their local water supply, were either generally about constitutional issues or about the authority of the local health department or local government to require fluoridation or to begin to fluoridate the water supply. In every instance where constitutional arguments were raised, the challengers to fluoridation lost. The courts very consistently found that there was no fundamental right at issue, there was no due process violation, and that there was a rational basis for the water fluoridation ordinance. And similarly, in almost every instance, it appeared that the courts were seeking opportunities to affirm that, in fact, the local government did have the authority to pass the ordinance. And in some cases, the challenges did deal with issues of procedure as to whether the ordinance had been duly and appropriately passed. But in general, the courts were very generous in a way that we don't see in tobacco control with the authority to fluoridate water. Preemption came up only in one case, and that was that City of Manchester case. There were very few cases that raised issues about express or implied preemption by a state law. And that's very interesting because in tobacco control, that is the primary argument that's being made, that a local government is preempted because of something that's implied in the state law. So very, very interesting in comparison. And actually one of the courts, I think, said it best. When it comes to fluoridation, courts throughout the United States have uniformly held that the fluoridation of water is a reasonable and proper exercise of the police power in the interests of public health. And I would actually go one step further and say that the courts not only have found that it's a reasonable exercise of police power, they found that it's not a due process violation, and that states and localities have very broad authorities to require water fluoridation. So there's two cases that are sort of exceptions to the rule. One is the City of Fargo case, and in that case, the consumer sued the person receiving the water who would have received the fluoridated water. This is back in 1953-54, by the way. Sued the city for a breach of contract. He claimed that the city had an obligation to provide him with pure water, and that fluoridated water was somehow impure, would make him sick. The court ruled on a procedural matter on appeal that they would allow the case to continue. They did not rule on the fluoridation issue. They didn't tell us the rest of the story. And one of the drawbacks to online legal research these days is that you miss when a case is remanded from a court of appeals back down to a lower trial court. You don't always get to see the final opinion of the court. So we don't know if he actually won the breach of contract claim. I suspect not, or I suspect I would have seen it cited elsewhere in other cases. But I'd love to know. So if anyone's from North Dakota and can help me find the case, that would be great. In the City of Manchester case, this to me was very interesting because this is the state of New Hampshire, which for those who are familiar with public health law issues, you may know that the state of New Hampshire has a long history of deep thinking and engagement about the degree to which local government should have the ability to regulate public health. And it's not always been favorable to public health. But in that particular case, the City of Manchester held a vote to fluoridate the water supply. So it was a citywide referendum. However, the waterworks company, the Manchester Waterworks Company, actually served multiple communities in the surrounding area that were too small to support their own waterworks. And the court found that there was a state statutory scheme that allowed local jurisdictions to determine whether to fluoridate their own water supply. And because this involved other municipalities in addition to the City of Manchester, and the challengers were from cities other than the City of Manchester, the city would not be able to continue fluoridating the water supply. And then the court goes on to say the resolution would be to amend the state law. So some interesting things going on in New Hampshire. New Hampshire has also had some very significant changes in their tobacco control related law as well. So things may be shifting somewhat in New Hampshire. So overall findings. Challenges to state or local ordinances, fluoridation ordinances that have been based on the following arguments have generally been unsuccessful. Cases in which the challenger makes arguments about insufficient delegation of authority to the local health department, the improper exercise of police powers, that fluoridation is somehow forced medication. The courts have rejected these arguments. They have rejected the notion that fluoridation is somehow forced on people with a lack of informed consent, or that fluoridation or fluoride is an unapproved drug by the FDA. The courts have heard and uniformly rejected all of these arguments. The risks to fluoridation ordinances seem to be primarily procedural. There are, in some cases, issues related to the scope of home rule authority, and the courts seem to consider those. But again, no successful challenge is really based on those yet. And the other risk is the sort of form of the ordinance and whether proper procedure was followed when the ordinance was passed. So lessons learned in the tobacco study I mentioned earlier, the lessons learned included that it shouldn't be assumed that state and local governments have the power, or that local governments have the power to promote and protect the public from tobacco-associated risks. Instead, local ordinances on tobacco control should be crafted in accordance with the requirements of each state's statute. And that public health and local officials should work together to understand the nuanced relationship between the law and their public health practice. And what was very interesting to me in this research was that the lessons for fluoridation, I think, are both similar and different. And it's very important that local ordinances, of course, be crafted in such a way that they don't conflict with their state law and therefore give rise to legal challenges. In fluoridation, there have been many more years of challenges, fewer cases. And despite less specificity, or maybe because of less specificity in state law related to fluoridation, challengers have been less successful with arguments about preemption. There's really only that one conflict preemption case in Washington, which again, distinguishing that from tobacco control, in which we have seen that in 9 or 10 cases. And challengers that raise constitutional issues with regard to water fluoridation seem to lose every time. Again, that's a little different than what we see in tobacco control and other public health interventions such as immunization. But there's still a need to be vigilant for changes in statutory authority that may affect the ability of local jurisdictions or states to fluoridate water. I like doing this kind of research, and I loved what I found in this instance because it's sort of a happy story. We've come a very long way in fluoridation, and despite the fact that we hear from time to time questions about whether it's good for people's health or whether it's being done appropriately, by and large, we seem to have the legal authorities in place. And again, that's not really something that we tend to see across public health, tobacco, obesity, immunization. We're always seeking preparedness. We're always seeking to improve our state public health laws. So this is a really, I think, a positive story for water quality. Thanks. Questions?
Has there ever been any specific health effect of fluoride?
So I am not a true expert on the on fluoride and its components. There have been a number of systematic reviews that I'm familiar with that indicate that at very high levels there are potentially some health risks and there are some cosmetic risks to your teeth associated with the consumption of a lot of fluoride. But in general, the type of fluoride that's used in most public water supply systems at the level it's used there's no evidence to suggest that it causes long-term health impacts. And in fact, the evidence suggests that it prevents a lot of things that come with tooth decay. So. Any other questions?
Regarding tobacco use and public health, how do the arguments differ from those for fluoride in that courts are ruling differently?
So one of the major things that we have seen with the state level challenges to tobacco control ordinances have been this notion that local governments are preempted from taking action. And the reason why those court decisions where they have found that local action is in fact preempted are so important is because in tobacco control, one of the ways that policy researchers and people who are experts in behavior change have pursued sort of systematic behavior change over the past 20 years is engaging a local community in making that decision for themselves to go smoke free. And if you get enough local communities to go smoke free, it's kind of like getting enough healthcare organizations to go green. If you get enough of them, perhaps you reach a tipping point and then you can achieve state level change, and then the goal a lot of tobacco control advocates have obviously is national level change. So fluoridation, we worry that if somehow in local communities they were losing ground on fluoridation the way they have sort of seesawed a little bit in tobacco, if they did lose ground in that way, it could be very detrimental overall to the sort of national progress that we have made. So.
In the case of tobacco, we know that economic interests are behind this. Do you think that in the insufficient fluoridation of water was the same reason? Or?
Well,
are there other interests?
Yeah, I mean, obviously tobacco and what water you consume are so totally different in some ways. You know, there isn't a clear financial interest in challenging fluoridation ordinances. I think the interests are primarily philosophical or religious in nature that I've seen. You know, so I think that's a major difference with tobacco, where you actually have, and there is documentation that the industry has been funding people to bring legal challenges to cases. But, you know, still in light of that, there's roughly similar numbers of cases in fluoridation and tobacco control. So, any other question?
Just a comment to follow up that, I'm sorry, later in this presentation. I just happen to be somewhat familiar with some fluoridation discussions in Oregon. And actually, the objections there were more scientific. It wasn't religious. There wasn't necessarily philosophical. It was, the opponents had looked at the science, especially the National Academy of Sciences report that came out, that raised some questions on it. So that's, at least the issues there, they were looking at specific scientific studies and using that to oppose the fluoridation.
So, and that one of the two comments about your comment, one is that also tells you that the fluoridation debate really is alive. We haven't seen that many recent legal challenges, but I think I would anticipate that based on some of the things I've read, we might see a few more cases in the near future. And then also, yeah, my presentation was not about what the appropriate level of fluoridation is. It was purely about legal challenges. And what's interesting is the courts spend almost no time looking at or reviewing the type of fluoride used, the level of fluoridation. They simply have been shutting down the challenges, which, depending on your perspective, you might think is a good thing or a bad thing. One more question, I think.
It was not a question. I just wanted to, I'm also from Oregon, and I wanted to echo your point about it being alive. I work in a one company, and I get calls on a regular basis about whether or not we fluoridate the water we don't use there. And the calls are always, people are concerned that we do, and they prefer that we don't. And both the community where I work and the community where I live don't fluoridate the water. And there were, too much opposition to it for it to work out.
Interesting. Thank you.
Our next presenter is Jose, and I will let him pronounce his last name for you.
Thank you.